Hello and welcome to Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen, and like a lot of you, I'm working from home today. I'm broadcasting from my living room. Pennsylvania Governor Wolf announced last night that all schools in the state are closed through April 6th. In addition, 5.5 million people living in seven counties, including Philadelphia, Montgomery, Bucks, Delaware, and Chester, are under a stay-at-home order. The Philadelphia School District is the largest in the state with more than 100,000 students. While other districts have set up classes online, Philadelphia has not, at least not yet, because so many of the students do not have access to the right technology, things like laptops and tablets. Joining us is Dr. William Height, and he is the superintendent of the Philadelphia School District to tell us about what the district is doing for students and teachers. And Dr. Height, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. How are the students? How are the teachers? How are you doing now in the second week of the school closure?
Yeah, I mean, this is all stressful. I mean, and we are working as fast and as urgently as we can to actually provide supports for students, supports for educators, and really, more importantly, supports for families that are dealing with a lot of other issues right now. We started this with making sure that we have meal distribution sites available. Many of our children get meals while at schools. Yesterday, we distributed more than 52,000 meals to students, which surpassed the number that we did all of last week. And we expanded the number of district schools that are serving meals now to 49, but we reduced the days that those sites are open. And we reduced those to Mondays and Thursdays from 9 a.m. to noon. However, each student can pick up six grab-and-go meals, three breakfasts and three lunches when they arrive at the school. And so that was really to ensure that we were within and we were scheduling to allow for fewer trips for families during the week. We also know that charter schools have been providing some meals along with the Philadelphia Housing Authority community centers. And so all of that information is available on philasd.org and on the city's website at phila.gov.
And just one follow-up, and then I do want to get to some other things that the district has been doing. Can we say then that children in Philadelphia, school children, they are not hungry because they have access to these grab-and-go meals?
Yeah, well, we can't say that all are not. We want to increase that number. We serve on a daily basis while we're in school about 100,000 children, breakfast and lunch every day. Yesterday, we delivered about 57,000 meals. And so we want to make sure that we have as many sites available for these young people to get meals and to pick them up. And so we're trying to reduce that number of individuals. We would love to say that no one will go hungry, no child will go hungry because we have these resources available, but we're still in the process of making sure individuals know where they can pick these up and the times that they're available.
I think it's important to clear up any kind of confusion. I know a memo was sent out last week to teachers essentially banning online teaching. Has that been amended, and what is the thinking behind that?
Yeah, I mean, and so that was an attempt to standardize a process, and it was really the wording of that could have been better. In fact, could have been a lot better. And so we, throughout this process, we are encouraging teachers to communicate with their students, and we want them to stay connected with their students to ensure the special relationships that they share and have maintained. We want those maintained during the closure. So we want to encourage teachers to talk to students about the learning guides that we have produced, that we have made available and are available at the meal distribution sites. We want them to post and share additional online learning resources with students and families that are self-guided and be available via email, phone, other platforms like Google Classroom, Infinite Campus, Class Dojo. And they can voluntarily answer student and family questions, support their learning, and make sure that some of our children, because their children, will forget their passwords to many things that they have, that the teachers have the keys for. And so that we have a student portal. All of our students have email accounts, Google Classroom, and selected online programs and interventions. Teachers may need to help children remember their passwords with that. The communication from last week was really in response to guidance that we had received from PDE and from the USDOE. They have since revised that guidance, and that guidance was essentially that we had to ensure that all children had access to whatever learning activities that we were creating. And because we could not do that, we sent out that direction that we didn't want individuals grading material or taking attendance. Then a lot of people understood that to be no contact with students whatsoever, and that was not what was meant. So we amended that communication, and those communications got that out to teachers and students and families and principals.
But can a teacher teach the way they would in a classroom? The children, yes, are home, but can they conduct a class online?
Someone can conduct a class online, yes. I will say, though, Monty, and this is about managing expectations on this, classes online will not look like a class during the school day, nor will it be a sufficient replacement for a teacher to student instruction that they have. And so people are finding that children are finishing activities much faster than they do during a school day. And that's typical when you have a one-to-one situation, mm-hmm. but teachers can teach and run a class. One of our things that we're trying to ensure is that as many children as possible have access to those learning opportunities. And that's what we are planning for in the future. And in the event that I know we are getting these announcements, and these announcements are in 2-week intervals, but we're setting up for a much longer term plan that then will provide all children who do not have access to technology or to the internet, those resources. And so we're in the process of determining how we can both acquire and then distribute thousands of Chromebooks to our young people, and then make sure that they have access to the internet.
There must be some degree of urgency, because we know the school year is done in a couple of months, and if the closures are at 2-week increments, it's hard to plan ahead. How soon would you like to get laptops and tablets into the hands of school children?
Yeah, I mean, so we want to do that within the next couple of weeks. And so we're in the process now of figuring out what some of our schools already have that, but very few, considering the number of schools we have. We have over 200 schools. We think we have about 20 that where children have access to computers, and even fewer that have allowed those children to take those computers home. So one of the things that we want to do is, number one, determine who already has distributed those machines to young people, and then we're just going to have any child that needs one, we're going to have those available. And we have to think of a distribution schedule, but we want to do that we want to have this process begin by the first week of April.
So in a couple of weeks. You know, I'm thinking of students at risk in the Philadelphia school system, perhaps kids who have problems at home. And oftentimes teachers are on the first front line. They'll see when a student comes to school what their mood is or what their temperament is, what they look like, how disheveled they might be. They might even look for things like bruises. How can the district stay on top of some of the emotional and social needs that children have?
Yeah, I mean, that's why we're really encouraging individuals to continue to contact and be in contact with their students. And those are those special relationships. I mean, you can do some of that virtually, but that's hard to do if it's on a phone call or if children are just on some site that in doing work. And so that's why we are encouraging individuals to stay in touch with children, be available for them and their families, and make sure that they are still a trusted source if a child is having or experiencing difficulty or and or problems.
Well, we know that parents play such a pivotal role in their children's education. What support does the district have specifically for parents?
Yeah, so one of the things that we have, one of the things that we've been able to establish are a couple of things. One, we now have hotlines, and those hotlines are available in multiple languages. I think they are available in 9 languages. And so the parents can go to our website and determine the language in which they need to pose a question, and then the hotline is also available. We've also created a set of coronavirus frequently asked questions, and we are capturing those questions. And so those questions deal, they're in categories. And so they're meals for students, remote learning and teaching, standardized tests and college placement, effects of closure, general questions about the closure, and then there's a whole section on wellness resources, both for parents and other adults.
Well, we're almost out of time here. You've been a longtime educator. Have you ever, in your professional life, experienced what we're experiencing now with schools?
Have never. One, we had the opportunity as a superintendent of a different district to experience H1N1, if you recall that from several years ago. And we had to close 3 schools, Marty. I mean, and they were closed by the health director. We've never had an experience of a citywide or statewide or countrywide or national pandemic that we're dealing with now. And there's no playbook for this. And so we're designing it literally as we are experiencing it. And that's one of the reasons we're capturing a lot of this information and making it available for our families and for our teachers. And so this is all new, and I've been in contact with my colleagues from around the country, and we're all struggling with trying to figure out next steps. But we want to make sure there's a continuity of learning as best we can. We want to also ensure that we are serving as many students as we can, and that's why we here in Philadelphia want to get the technology into the hands of our students.
Well, this is critical work, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. William Height, the superintendent of the Philadelphia Public School System, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking about some practical suggestions, support that you can get for yourself and for your kids as we struggle through these tough times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moskowain, and you're
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm broadcasting from my living room, as I have been for the last week. 158 people in 16 states, 9 counties, and 3 cities have been ordered to stay at home because of the novel coronavirus pandemic. And schools across the country, including in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, are closed for the foreseeable future. It's a scary time for everyone because we don't know how long this will last, who will succumb to COVID-19, and what it will take to end this crisis. Parents sequestered at home with their children have unique concerns. How to make it through the day, how to address their children's concerns, how to address and ensure they don't fall behind academically, and how to manage their own anxieties. It's stressful being a parent under normal circumstances, but these are not normal times. We asked Dr. Tina Payne Bryson to join us. She's a psychotherapist, a clinical social worker, founder and executive director of the Center for Connection. Her latest book, The Power of Showing Up, is co-authored with Dan Siegel. And Tina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I'm so excited to join you this morning to help support parents during this time.
Absolutely. And I have a million questions for you. Let me just tell our listeners how they can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, and we'll work you into the conversation. I've been beginning all my interviews for the last week or so asking our guests, how are you doing? How are you doing, Tina Payne Bryson?
That's so lovely to start there. I'm doing well. I've had too much news at times and needed to get outside and move. And when I'm sleeping and out moving and connecting with my kids for not too long a period of time, then I do pretty well. How are you doing, Marty?
I'm doing the same. I don't have kids at home. I have a son and daughter-in-law up in New York, and a grandson, and frankly another one on the way. So we stay connected in as many different ways as we can, but obviously we can't see each other. But as a parent myself, I think the impulse is to try to fix things for our children.
Right.
And we are in a situation where we are not in control of this virus. We're not in control of our government in any direct kind of way. What is your advice to parents?
You know, there's one really important thing that we have to start with, and that is that you're right, we can't control this. And there's about 50 years of research that shows that there's really one thing that is one of the best predictors for how well our kids turn out. And that is that they have what's called secure attachment with at least one person. And what's cool about secure attachment and what's neat about the attachment system is that as mammals, it's actually an inborn system that allows us to seek out help when we are in distress. And this attachment system allows us to feel safe and survive things well and to come out with some resilience. So what I mean by secure attachment is really that the parent or the caregiver is not perfect. So we can mess up all the time with our kids as long as we repair with them. But really what our kids need most from us is this secure attachment. And in my book, The Power of Showing Up with Dan Siegel, we really talk about how that's about four S's. And that's really that we help our kids feel safe. So this is keeping in mind, this is really what they need most from us, particularly when they're in distress, which is right now. So they need us to help them feel safe. They need us to help them feel seen, where we really just say, I can see how you're feeling. I understand you. So we really kind of connect with the mind behind their behavior. The third S is that we help them be soothed. So we comfort them. We nurture them when they're having a hard time. And when enough times, particularly in distress, they feel safe, seen, and soothed by us, then they get that fourth S, which is called secure attachment, which is really the idea that they've had enough repeated experiences that their brain wires to know that if I have a need, if I'm in distress, someone will show up for me. And what's great about that is that then by the time they become adults, their brain wires for how they can do that for themselves. They can keep themselves safe, seen, soothed, and expect that in their relationships as well. So I guess the main thing I'm going to want to focus on, and I can give lots of practical things too, but what our kids need most from us is us. What your kids need most from you, listeners, is you, flawed, imperfect, sometimes stressed yourself, you. But they really just need us to show up for them.
Well, and you know, in many ways, we're stuck in a apartment or a house together. So we are being with them, but there's being with someone physically and being with them emotionally. How much should kids know about their parents' own fears and anxieties about the times that we're living in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you made a good point there. Being physically present isn't the same as being present, right? I can be physically present in the room with my kids all day and on my screen and on the news and and really not at all connected to them. And we don't have to, you know, have sustained eye contact with, you know, emotionally reflective conversations all day long. That would be exhausting. No one can do that. Yes, it would
be. Too hard.
And it's too hard. I don't want that with anyone. I need some space too. But I think that we need to remember our children are not our therapists, and that we set the emotional tone for our children. That when if there are stressed parents, there are going to be stressed kids. And so the way that we do this is that we know that right now things are really unpredictable. They change all the time. Many of us are concerned about finances. Many of us are concerned about health issues. There are many, many things that are weighing heavily on us. And this is a wonderful opportunity for parents to learn that we cannot bubble wrap our children and protect them from everything. But our job isn't to fix everything, but to walk with our children through it. And so this is also a wonderful opportunity for us to model how to handle big emotions and hard things in ways that teach our kids skills. So I think the biggest thing that we have to think about around this question is if we are in internally chaotic, fearful states, that's how our children are going to feel, and it's going to be hard for them to feel safe. So what we can do is when we're feeling that, because we all are feeling that, is that we can say, gosh, I'm feeling a lot of stress. I'm listening to the news, or I'm hearing things, and you're probably hearing things. This is a really hard thing for us to understand, and we need to give the and. Mm-hmm. And we are here together. All the grown-ups are working hard to solve the problem, and I'm feeling kind of stressed right now. I'm going to go move my body. I'm going to go do some stretches, or let's go read a book and give our minds a break for a little bit. So we can really model some self-care there. That's really important as well.
And I wonder too whether this is a good time to ask children for their help, what they want to do, how they want to fill their day, as opposed to relying on a parent to come up with 18 hours worth of activities.
Oh my goodness. You've probably seen a lot of those schedules that have
I have,
on the internet,
yes.
The color-coded schedules. And, you know, when I see the first day or two, I'm thinking, oh, that's a great idea. And every parent I know that has created one of those on day three is like, this is not sustainable. I'm exhausted. And I think, you know, those color-coded schedules we create and the plans we make and the lists we make, those are all things that we're doing to feel a sense of control. And those are things that we're doing to help ourselves feel safe. So if that helps you feel safe, great. But when I look at that schedule, if my husband handed me a schedule like that, I would rip it up. I don't want my day scheduled like that. And I love that idea, Marty, of having a kid say, you know, have a say in it. And, you know, in fact, parents historically, really, as we watch sort of how parenting has happened over, you know, decades, right now we're in a decade where parents are hyper involved in their child's life, even their older adolescents. And this is a great time to give them some say, even if they're young. And I'm a big fan of asking kids to use their prefrontal cortexes, meaning I don't solve all the problems and I don't come up with all the plans. So my boys are currently 13, 17, and my 20-year-old college kid just had to move back home. And so I say, hey, what's your plan for getting exercise today? Instead of go get exercise
nagging
today
them.
Between 3 and 3:30,
right?
So yeah,
right.
Give them some say in it. I think that's a really good thing. Give them a sense of control.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Dr. Tina Payne Bryson. She's a psychotherapist, a clinical licensed clinical social worker, I should say, founder, executive director of the Center for Connection, which is located out in California. She's written a bunch of books, and her latest one, co-authored with Dan Siegel, is called The Power of Showing Up. And we wanted her to join us on Radio Times because we know a lot of parents are home with their children trying to figure out how to manage the day and also to deal with some of the concerns that their children might have or they might have about the state of the world. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave us a message, a comment, a story, a suggestion on our Facebook page as well. How much And you know, we're all sort of plugged into the news, but at the same time, thinking with a house full of children or one or two children, in case of you, three children, just sort of how much you feel you want to know and that it's good for children to know about what's going on in the world, the kind of day-to-day news that comes in.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing for us to be really intentional about because, you know, as a clinician, you know, I would see kids and teenagers in my office all the time. And I'll tell you, kids, the younger kids that I saw, particularly those, you know, who were between like 4 and say 12, mm-hmm. I had lots and lots of experiences where kids were dealing with anxiety. There were other things going on in their lives that contributed to that in a complex way. But a lot of them had families that had the news on all the time, and they talked about all the horrible things that were happening in the world. And so we have to be developmentally appropriate. It's really important that we don't ignore what's happening and that we don't talk. You know, we can't not talk about it.
Sure.
When we don't talk about it at all, our kids don't have any way to wrap their brain around it. It helps them actually not feel safe if they know nothing, because they know something's going on, but the grown-ups aren't talking to them about it. So one of the things that Dan Siegel and I talk about is something called name it to tame it, which is where you actually name what you're feeling and you tell the story of what's happening, but in a developmental way. So there are wonderful resources. PBS.org has great things. And on my website, which is TinaBryson.com, I've got a resource sheet on there with all kinds of ways to talk to kids. It's not stuff I've written. It's just stuff I've collected that's come out that's really wonderful, cartoons to talk to kids about it. But I think it's really important that we are careful. If we have the news on all the time and we're talking about it all the time, our kids are swimming in that.
Yeah.
And if we just tune into how we're feeling when we're watching it for long periods of time, know that our kids feel that, but probably even more amplified. So giving them developmentally appropriate information. And then again, at the end, always saying, you know, it looks like they're learning a little bit more each day. So we end those conversations with something positive. And I would also say that we want to create space. Whether it's at bedtime or at dinner time, if your kids are older and you're having conversations, to just do check-ins and sometimes not even specifically directly ask, how are you feeling about this? Or, you know, what's changed this week that's been the hardest for you? You know, those kinds of questions are good, but we can also just at bedtime or driving, actually, we're not driving in the car, are we?
We're not.
playing, you know, tossing a ball in the house, times where you're not specifically looking at each other and having conversations, but you're doing something together, to just allow periods of quiet so that things can come up and kids can kind of allow for moments for them to bring things up as well.
I often wonder, and kids have such antenna for their caregivers or their parents' moods and emotions, that what we say is maybe less important than how we say it, that tone matters, especially under stressful times.
Oh, so important. That's exactly right. You know, the left hemisphere tries to unpack and understand the words, but the right hemisphere is listening to all the nonverbal stuff. And we trust our right hemispheres more than we trust our left hemispheres. Like if I say, I'm not angry, Marty.
Right. I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah. You know, I am, right? So our children pick up on all that. And I think that's, again, back to that part of we have got to make sure that we are regulating ourselves and that we are finding ways to calm ourselves. One really good way to do that is to go outside for just a minute or even look out a window and take in some natural world. And then another thing we can do is to breathe in a way where our inhale is like a count of 4 and our exhale is a count of 6. Whatever it is, you can pick the numbers. But when we breathe out longer than we breathe in, that actually kind of turns down our nervous system arousal, taking time to calm ourselves, because they will pick up on this. And in a bigger way, especially if your kids are young, they won't remember a lot of the specifics about what the coronavirus was, or, you know, they'll say, oh, yeah, I didn't go to school for a while. But their impression is really going to be more about what was that experience like being in the house with my family or with my parent. What was that like? And so they'll sort of take away this more abstract, generalized feeling. So just like you're saying, it's not so much the words, but how we say it, the feel of what we're saying it. That's what this experience in a bigger way is going to be like. They're going to walk away. What was the feel of that experience? And I hope that a lot of kids walk away with that saying, gosh, that was really hard. My family got through it together, versus that was a terrifying, horrible experience. My parents were so upset, you know, like that kind of thing. So I think just thinking about what is it you're communicating to your kids about in general, how this is going to be overall.
And I think for a lot of parents, it's just, you know, you're going to turn the TV on because you need a break, or maybe you have to get some work done, and maybe even breaking some of the rules that you had set before this pandemic forced us all home.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, some kids are on spring break right now. Some of them are doing online learning. Some of them are not doing online learning because the schools are working right now fast and furiously to try to create opportunities for fair educational access. Right. There's a lot happening. I think now is the time to not feel like you have to win the Parent of the Year award and turn into a homeschool educator and be the best baker and learn how to, you know, if the first couple of days people were like, oh, this is great. I'm going to learn, you know, I'm going to learn another language, or I'm going to learn how to make a souffle or whatever. And I'm thinking now our best bet, particularly if we have kids at home, is to lower our expectations, lower our expectations of ourselves and our kids, give them some leeway, keeping in mind that we're going to see a lot more difficult behaviors right now because they're out of their routines. They're not having time with their friends. They're not having their, you know, their schedule at school. They're with us all the time. You know, just like they bug us when we're with them for long periods of time, sure. We bug them too. So I think it's fine if kids are watching more television than usual. I think it's fine if they're being a little lazier than usual. I think we can give ourselves some space to be just good enough parents. And I also think around the education stuff, depending on the age of your kid, a lot of what happens the rest of the semester in some ways is going to be a wash. A lot of kids are not going to learn much at all, even if they have access to learning, because they're in stressed out states.
Sure.
And a kid who is, you know, the way our brains are best primed to learn is when we feel safe and connected and engaged. That might be really hard for most kids right now. So I think we can kind of say, okay, well, we are not in an academic crisis right now, and it's totally fine if our kids are accessing learning as best they can, and we can let it go. What's more important is that I hate the idea of a parent enforcing a full school day, which is actually not appropriate. Even for high schoolers, just 3 to 4 hours of school throughout the day is much more appropriate when we're doing it from home, and way less for younger kids.
You know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And we have a guest waiting in the wings to join our conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the fact that schools are shut down for the foreseeable future. We're trying to figure out how to balance the needs of our kids and handle the stresses of the pandemic. Have been talking with Tina Payne Bryson about some practical suggestions, some support that you can give to yourself and to your children in these tough times. And we asked Imani Perry to join us. She's home with her two sons, Issa and Freeman, whom she wrote about in her book, Breathe. She's a professor of African-American studies at Princeton University. And Imani, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. How are you and your sons doing?
We're doing fairly well, all things considered. You know, it's generally stressful, but I think that we are doing a good job of trying to tend to our health and tend to each other and be reflective, and also think about, you know, what our responsibilities are to the world at large in addition to ourselves.
Are you surprised that you're doing well? You sounded a little surprised.
Well, I should say yes. I mean, it's an up and down, and I think that's also sort of one of the things that it's okay to acknowledge, right? When you have moments of joy, you feel joy, and then there are the moments when we weep, and they come unexpectedly, and you sort of ride your way through them. Because I think that both the devastation of witnessing so much hardship, and also the ways in which human beings still try to find happiness is a is a beautiful thing, and you know, we have to be honest about all of it, I think. The uncertainty. Yeah.
The uncertainty, absolutely. You tweeted recently some advice to your boys. Talk to your friends, go outside, read, listen to music, brush your teeth, take a bath. Those are the kind of basics. But you also said that you're really more concerned about their emotional health than their academics.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the academic piece, despite the fact that we tend to sort of be in our culture maniacal about what we wanted, the deliverables and the achievements and the things that those things can be made up some other time. But the emotional impact in a stage of, you know, really critical, my kids are adolescents, a critical stage of human development, I think is something to really attend to now and to try to figure out how they sustain connections. This is a time for when you grow, you know, how you interact with other human beings. So this is, it's really hard to happen now. And these are kids all over the world are experiencing it. So trying to figure out how to usher them through this, I think, is much more important.
Let me get Tina Payne Bryson back in on the conversation. You also have teenage children. And obviously for teenagers, they crave a kind of distance from their family. And now everyone's all in the same room or the same house or same apartment together. Are there suggestions in particular for adolescents, Tina?
Hi. Yeah, my boys are 13, 17, and 20, and I think it's particularly difficult for our kids who are used to living away from us and have moved home, or who have, you know, driver's licenses and who can leave, or have friends who do, or they take public transportation and leave the house. I think sitting down as a family and saying, okay, I know you're used to having some independence. We're all sort of stuck here together. How are we as a family going to figure out how to give each other some space? And developmentally right now, there is that drive for them to differentiate and to be their own people. And so I think on the one hand, we do want to find ways, if we're not in a physical space where we can have distance from each other, even having headphones on and kind of finding, you know, a corner, those are going to be really important moments. And then, no, it just keep reassuring them that, you know, this is a limited period of time. The other thing I would say, which is sometimes surprising to parents of teenagers, is often, and this is not always the case, but often they still enjoy fun family time. And so, and regardless of the age of your kids, if you can find a moment, it doesn't even have to be every day. If they're young, it does need to be every day. But a time of play or playfulness together, of shared joy, whether you get out old board games or you're playing charades or you're, you know, having some sort of competition around something, that kind of thing, they will still enjoy that for the most part. They don't have to always be differentiated as well.
Do you agree with that, Imani?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we, for us, it's around music and dancing and, you know, jokes. I mean, I think that's, you know, I keep thinking about my grandmother in this moment because she parented 12 children in an age that was terrifying and in a very different way. But, you know, they were in Jim Crow, Alabama. They were in the neighborhood that was being bombed all the time. There was a lot of uncertainty and fear. And she really taught us, and I'm sort of pulling up her lessons, how to find small pleasures every day and to relish them. And I think that's true. And it also becomes something that I think you can hang on to for the long term, right? When you don't know what's going to happen, when you're afraid to understand that, like, even the little joke or the, you know, the moment of doing something small together can have a huge impact.
I want to put this to both of you, but to you, Tina, and I'm thinking it is an opportunity. I mean, we see how connected we are with everyone in the world. I mean, this virus has done that to us and for us so that we see that we're all part of this planet. And I wonder if there are lessons in particular for children that can, if not inspire them, make them feel some connection to this great big world that we live in.
Yeah, it is a great opportunity. And I think our kids are seeing that even just, I don't know what the weather's like there in California. It's fairly nice outside. And our kids are seeing so many neighbors out walking and talking to each other from across the street. And really every day we're finding something somewhere you all have seen that beautiful video of the people in Italy singing from their balconies. Yeah. And to really, you know, we have to remember that what we give attention to is what actually gets strengthened in the brain. So if we give attention to gratitude or what, Imani, you were just saying about moments of beauty, moments of joy, if we focus our attention on those, not in a way that distracts us from looking at the hard stuff and being real about that, but if we find moments that we can savor like that and you bring attention to say, wow, look at all these millions of people are staying home so that older people are safe and so that the disease doesn't continue to hurt so many people. All of these kinds of things that we give attention to can fire and wire for empathy in their brain and other ways to start having that become a set point for them, that they're looking for moments of beauty. They're looking for ways that as a country and as a community that we're coming together and as a world too, really.
And Imani, final question to you. I mean, I think this virus has also revealed what has been sort of hidden in plain sight, the kind of inequities, injustices, and the, you know, I think the question for the country is, are we going to address these? Or are we going to paper over them? And, you know, hopefully once we get on the other side of this pandemic, sort of pretend like it never happened, or are we going to make us a better country?
Yes.
I don't know. I think that's really the big question.
That's the question. Yeah, that's the question. And I guess I think part of what we do for and with children right now is to raise some of these ethical questions, because I do think we can cultivate a generation out of this terrible, terrible moment that can do much better than we have in trying to have a sense of, you know, the fact that we're all of one garment. Right. We have a mutual destiny.
Well, I'm going to leave it on that note. Imani Perry, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. And she's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. We're staying with Tina Payne Bryson. She's a psychotherapist. We're talking about how to make it through these tough times, especially when parents and children are home together, trying to manage their emotions, their concerns, the hours of the day. And again, you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we got a Facebook page. You can leave a comment there as well and tell us how you are doing. I wonder, Tina, if you could also speak. I mean, this is more a political question about just, you know, maybe we can be a better country. Maybe we can be a better family because of what we're going through now.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, it's really important. We obviously, a lot of us have strong political opinions and we're watching the news and you know, it's really easy to have big, you know, verbal storms of reactivity to what we see and what we disagree with. And I think it's important that our kids know what we think and what we believe, but the way that we say it matters a lot too. And what's so important too is to, again, look for the positivity. And, you know, when Dan and I talk about and write about this idea, name it to tame it, it's really the idea that we're naming the facts, we're talking about how we feel about what's happening, and then we always end that story with something positive, either something we can do, a strategy we can adapt to help us be more resilient, or something good that happened, like a good ending. And if you have little kids, make a book with them. Have them help you. And, you know, it doesn't have to be fancy and digital. It can be paper and staplers and crayons. But make a book about what's been happening, how the kid feels about it. And then, you know, the end of that story is something like, the grownups are figuring out how to be better problem solvers and neighbors are helping each other. You know, so we really want to focus on that. I am an eternal optimist, and I really believe that what we give attention to is going to amplify. And so if we are going to be a better country and a better community and better families, and I do believe that's possible, mm-hmm. we do it through connection. We do it through generosity. We do it through empathy. These are things that are wired deep within us, but we have to settle our own internal chaos first. And so that self-care is essential if we are going to be able to shine the light on the good things that happen and to be able to provide what we call in our book a safe harbor. You know, there's a storm happening. We become a safe harbor in our family where our kids know that we're a safe person. We're creating a safe environment, and we can do that in our communities and world as well.
You talk about connection, and we're told to keep our distance from other people. So we're in this very sort of strange environment. But I do take issue with this notion of social distancing, because I think it's more about physical distancing, because what I see, and I'm participating in this social contact with people almost all day long online or on the phone.
Yeah.
Or I mean, I do see and feel and even experience a deep connection to the people in my life. I'm just not seeing them.
It's been remarkable, I think, too. You know, again, with teenage boys, we've asked them to find ways to connect with grandparents. And we have three grandparents who live in town and two that live out of state. And every day they're asked to connect with their grandparent in some way. That might be a funny meme that they send. It may be a phone call. We actually are going to have my parents who live in town but are medically vulnerable. Mm-hmm. They're going to be joining us for dinner via Skype tonight or Zoom. And we're going to set the computer on the table, and they're going to eat at the same time we're going to eat. And we're joining in that way. And I feel like my kids' relationships with their grandparents and with each other is really enriched right now because there's time and space for it. And, you know, they miss their friends, of course, but there are so many ways we can connect through our devices or, you know, just out waving at our neighbors and things like that we don't typically do. I think it's actually kind of lovely.
You mentioned meals, and I do want to talk about, you know, things like food and sleep and hygiene. I mean, as ways to manage stress. Can you speak to that?
Well, as a nation, we are chronically sleep deprived. And I rarely give a talk, regardless of who my audience is, where I don't talk about children's sleep in particular. Adolescents need like 9.5 hours of sleep a night, and it's so rare for them to get it. And we know that anxiety, depression, and suicidality, which has been a huge, we really are in a mental health crisis in our country for our young people. And we know that less sleep is tied to emotional reactivity and mood challenges. So we've got to, you know, I'm very much a coaching kind of parent as my kids get older. Again, like I said, instead of saying go get exercise or go to bed, I say, what's your plan for getting some exercise today? And then I follow up with them and all of those things. But when it comes to sleep, I am militant. they really, really need sleep. And if I have a family that comes to me because their children's having behavioral or mood problems as a clinician, I always ask about sleep, and I always start helping them get that on board. It's crucial. And now we may have the luxury to do that, to really sleep and know what it feels like to be rested. Every day kids should, even though we don't necessarily need a color-coded schedule, kids and adults should be getting some form of movement or exercise, some time of sleep, and some time of connection. Those are the three sort of main things besides the meals. We also, as parents, are finding ourselves having to set limits because I don't know about you, Marty, but I am not typically a snacker, but when I'm home all day, I just want to eat and eat and eat. You know, there's snacks everywhere.
True confessions here.
And kids want to bake, so there's, you know, there's extra right. stuff. So we may need to set limits around some of those things related to health as well.
Exactly. We will be waddling out of our apartments and houses when all of this is done. Well, Tina
exactly.
Payne Bryson, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, she's a psychotherapist, founder and executive director of the Center for Connection. Her latest book, co-authored with Dan Siegel, is called The Power of Showing Up. We also talked with Imani Perry about what she's doing with her children at home. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.